On Tuesday, January 8th at 10 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents a 2010 rebroadcast of an interview with Gary Bartz. Gary Bartz will be part of the Winter Jazz Festival celebrating the 50th anniversary of his release, Another Earth. That's Tuesday, January 8th at 10 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening is alto and soprano saxophonist, composer, educator, just all-around cool guy who is going to be part of the Winter Jazz Festival celebrating his Another Earth release. 20-something minutes, that song, and you really should hear it live. I couldn't play it tonight, though, but we'll hear other things, and we'll hear a lot from Gary Bartz, who visited WBAI in 2010 with his son, Keem Akeem. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
Hi, this is Joyce Jones, and I'm here with...
Keem. I go by Keem. Akeem is my real name.
And what's your last name?
Bartz.
And you're here with...
Gary Bartz.
Hi, Gary Bartz. Hi, Keem.
How you doing?
Thank you for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Oh, yeah, that's the name of the show?
That is
the name of the show. Oh, you better look out. We might be here all day.
Thank you once again for joining us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Tell me about yourself, Mr. Bartz.
Oh, my
Gary. How did you wind up playing this music?
Well, my family always had music around, and my uncle, who was my father's youngest brother, Leon Bartz, loved the music and had the records. He had the 78s, and we used to go by my grandmother's house where he was living at the time. And that was the highlight of every Sunday of every week, is that I could listen to these records. That was the main thing. And
Who did you listen to?
Louis Jordan, Nat King Cole, people as diverse as Bull Moose Jackson. Dinah Washington was a friend of his, and he used to go to New York and come back with stories about the musicians. I know he came back one time telling me about something that had happened when he went to see Dizzy Gillespie, which was really funny. I can't remember what it was. I just remember the feeling.
Where were you if you're not in New York?
Oh, I was in Baltimore. Yeah, I was born in Baltimore. Yeah, we all were born. Akeem also was born in Baltimore. So one Sunday, I put on this record that he had, and that got me. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard, and that was Charlie Parker. And at the time, I didn't even know what instrument it was. Could have been a woman, could have been a man. I didn't know what. I just heard the sound, and I remember saying to him, I was about 6 years old, and I said to myself, I want to do that. Mm. I really want to do that, whatever that is he's doing. I didn't even call it music. I didn't call it anything. I want to do that. And so I kept begging my parents every year for Christmas, what do you want for Christmas? I want a saxophone. I want that horn that that man plays. By that time, I knew who he was. Mm-hmm. And it took about 5 years, and finally, when I was 11, they bought me a saxophone for Christmas, and that's how I got started.
Do you remember what he was playing, what the song was?
It might have been Red Cross. I know that was one of the early ones that I heard.
So were you one of the Parkerites, the sort of disciples of Charlie Parker?
Probably.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was a disciple of musicians. You know, I guess you can call them disciples. I kind of look at it as a link in the chain, you know, and you pass it on from one musician. It's an oral tradition, oral and aural, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you pass it on, and so that's why the validity is when Louis Armstrong learned from Sidney Bechet, and Lester Young learned from whoever he learned from, Bird learned from whoever, you know, and we learned, and so you keep the chain. Nowadays, the chain is broken. Some people start away from the chain, not a part of the chain, and that's a bit of a problem for music, I think, music in general, but, you know.
You think there's any way that could be corrected?
Yeah.
And? How do
well,
you think
Well, I mean, how much time we have?
We have.
Well, I mean, just by keeping the links and by making sure. See, most band leaders, great band leaders, served apprenticeships in many bands before they became band leaders. Miles used to pick his bands. They were hand-picked. He would go out and listen to them, talk to them, get to know them. And by the time he chose musicians, most of them were already leaders, like Wayne Shorter, Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, Tony Williams, you know. You could go on down the line, you know, until a certain generation. And then a lot of them became band leaders. Ears were still open, you know, for not what kind of music, and which is a big problem. Everyone wants to know, what kind of music do you play? I mean, why? Do you like it? I mean, there is no kind of music. You know, to me, there's no kind of music other than, oh, I like that. Mm-hmm. That's what kind of music I like. I like music that I like. Good music, like Duke Ellington said.
Well, we were talking earlier about the concept of, quote, jazz, unquote. Do you want to share that with the listeners?
The J word?
The J word.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a word that's a very negative word. And I think negative words bring negative energies to things. You know, words are very powerful. Because a word is a form, even a thought form. So once you start imposing thought forms on art or anything, then you're guiding, you're beginning to brainwash people, mm-hmm. you know, rather than let them just listen and let them make up a name for it. Mm-hmm. You don't, you know, I don't, how is someone going to tell me, the artist, what the name of what I do is? Mm-hmm. I resent that. As Max did, I mean, I'm a child of Max Roach and Abby Lincoln, you know,
right.
this first band I was ever in. Parks when I was about 15 or 16. Mm-hmm. So when I came to New York, him and Happy looked after me. So his philosophy, I mean, he had a lot to do with my philosophy, but I totally am in agreement with the way he felt about it. And we had many discussions. And it is a negative word, which was not used by musicians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nowadays, younger musicians might use that word. And even some older musicians, you know, where they've been beaten down, you know. But I resent the word. I will not use the word. And I'm insulted when you call me that because I never set out to be that. I set out to be the best musician I could be. And that doesn't have anything to do with a genre, a style, or anything. You know, that's what I have to tell my students, you know, I'm teaching you how to play the saxophone. Now, you can play any kind of music you want to, but my interest is in teaching you how to play the saxophone. I can teach you how to compose on a song also, but in order to do that, you have to learn how to play the saxophone first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they want to learn how to play a music before they've learned how to play the instrument.
Mm.
And that's backwards.
Well, you were talking earlier about the origins of that J word.
Mm-hmm.
You want to share that with everybody
else?
Well,
you know, I mean, basically, there are many theories of where the word, some people think it came from a word that the Africans used on the ships coming over, you know, during the Middle Passage. Whenever they would have a session, have the drums, they said that's what they called it. But even if they did, the American origin of the word started in New Orleans in the houses of prostitution, because they called going down to the jazz house to get me some jazz, which meant a lady. Yeah, I'm going to get some jazz from that lady, you know. And so the music started in those houses. So when someone would say, well, what kind of music are they playing? They would say they're playing jazz music from the jazz houses. So it's a negative word.
Mm-hmm.
And the music is a very religious, magical thing, this music is. And to call it something as negative as that, I resent it. So did Max. Max would fist fight you.
Mm.
He literally was a drummer, you know,
right.
Drummers.
Oh, hi.
Yeah. And Mingus would do. Mingus would go, no, he hated that because how dare you? You know, here we've dedicated our lives to this music, and you're just going to tell us that this is what we're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Resent it, you know, and I'm not going to change, you know. So, you know, and I think they're not going to change either.
Right.
The business people are going to continue to call it that to the detriment of the music, because I can stop people on the street and ask them, who's your favorite? And I like I say, I don't like them. Who's your favorite J musician?
Mm.
And you might, on the same corner, all nationalities, all ages, one person might say John Coltrane. Another person might say Kenny G. Another person might say anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a word that doesn't mean anything. It's all over the place. And it's just, I think you should ask the musician, what music does he play, he or she plays?
Mm-hmm.
What do they call it? That's what's important, not what somebody says it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And plus, see, what happens is when you think like that, you're in a box.
Mm-hmm.
And you want us, the musicians, to be in that box with you because that makes you feel comfortable. Once I start doing something outside of that J box, everybody's uncomfortable, and I love making them uncomfortable.
Well, that would bring you, that would definitely bring you to, that would be your whole career. But I mean, I was getting ready to say, you know, the time with Miles, but that would pretty much be your whole career because with Max Roach and Abby Lincoln, they were considered, you know, out of the box.
Yeah, well, because there is no box.
Right.
It's only in the heads of small-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Keem, you want to speak to that? There's something you want to add?
Well. Nah, he tightened it up.
Okay,
tightened it up.
Well, tell me, Gary, about, since I talked about it, your time with Miles. Mm-hmm. How did you wind up playing with him? Mm-hmm. How did he wind up picking you?
Well, you know, I came to New York in 1958 at the age of 17 to go to Juilliard. And so it was a very vibrant time because it was the end of the bebop era, so they called it, you know, then, which is another word we don't use, bebop, mm-hmm. you know, but the end of the so-called bebop era. Charlie Parker had passed away 3 years previously, so, you know, the wake of him was still around, you know. And so I would see Miles hanging out at Birdland, you know, I'd go down and see him, and I would always, you know, and of course you want to be around them, you know, listen to what they're saying and listen. I didn't really know him. I got to know him a little bit when I was working with Max, and we did this engagement that people still talk about it at Count Basie's in Harlem. Two bands. We did 10 days a weekend and a week with the Max Roach band and Miles Davis's band. So he got to hear me every night. And I got to know him then, you know. And when I was working with McCoy Tyner, he came in to listen. And I guess he decided he wanted to hire me, and he called me a few days later and asked me to join the band. And I didn't believe it was really him because my friends and I would always call each other and imitate his voice. <You know? laughs>
That seems to be a big thing amongst musicians.
Yeah, you know. So I'm saying, who is this? He said, Gary, this is Miles. I want you to join the band. I'm saying, who is this? Is this Jack? Who is this? And finally, he began to get a little peeved, and I realized, oh, man, it's really him. But that's how I joined him.
Do you remember what year that was?
Oh, yeah, 1970.
And then you started playing live with him.
Yeah.
You joined his line band.
Mm-hmm. I think my third concert with him was the Isle of Wight.
Wow.
Thank you.
not seen that. That's incredible. Yeah. That was just amazing.
Oh, no, it was.
What was it like being in that sea of people? Yes.
Well, I mean, it's, of course, it's, I've never played before a larger group of people because it was over 500,000 people. And so just you come out on stage, and as far as you look, there were people. All the way, you know, people who about that big, and when you get to the back,
like ant size.
You know, so, yeah, it was amazing, you know. But I kind of feel like there's a story about Charlie Parker, and somebody asked him, "Ah, Mr. Parker, you know, you're getting ready to play Carnegie Hall, you know, this great hall. What do you think about that? You're finally playing Carnegie Hall." He said, "It's just another gig."
Okay.
Because you're going to play the same no matter whether you're in a tiny club with two people or in a big field with over 500,000 people. That's what you should be doing. You can't worry about it. It's not about that. It's about the music. So, yeah, but it was a great experience. I mean, Sly and the family stuff. Jimi Hendrix, that was his last big engagement. We went on. We were sandwiched between Tiny Tim and Joni Mitchell.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, see, but that's how music should be anyway. It shouldn't be all this or all that style or all that's boring to me. I mean.
Well, speaking of Olive White and that engagement, let's see, there was Chick Corea, you.
Keith Jarrett.
Keith Jarrett.
Yeah, we had two. Ayerto. And Jack DeJohnette.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Dave
Holland. Yes.
Yeah, can't forget Dave.
No.
Yeah.
Did you work well together? Did you learn well together? Did you learn anything from me?
I'll tell you one thing. It is that the way I felt at the time was, wow, he's calling me now to join the band. I wish he had called me earlier because that was the type of music. I mean, from the John Coltrane group, the classic with Red Call and Philly Joe and Paul Chambers, that's how I learned how to play, listening to that music, and then listening to Wayne Shorter and Herbie and Tony and Ron, that band. But now this is a totally different kind of music. This is electric. It's loud. It's, you know, and so I didn't, in my mind, I had resigned. I said, well, you know, I'll do this gig for a couple of weeks and, you know, but I'm sure, you know, I won't be in the band, I don't think. And the first few gigs, I was having problems hearing myself because everybody was electronic except me and the drums, where that's acoustic too. But I didn't have anything attached. Miles had a microphone attached and all kind of wah-wah pedals and stuff. And so I went to him. I said, Miles, I can't hear myself, you know. And in his classic way, you know, he went right to the point. He said, what you telling me for? Tell the sound man. We have a sound man, you know, who does that. See, I'd never been in a band with a sound man before, so I didn't know. So then I did that. So once I began to get that together, I began to understand what it was he was doing. He wasn't doing anything different. He was playing the same way. He was playing better than ever, really. Just the music, because the times changed. Different. Now we have new instruments. So what? We're musicians. We're not supposed to use new instruments or explore things. No, stay in that box. You stay in that box. But fortunately, he didn't.
Right.
And fortunately for us, most of the great, well, most all of the great musicians were outside of the public's box. And even artists such as Picasso, that goes into all genres. You know, I mean, when he started painting his more modern stuff, they thought he was nuts too. Like they thought Beethoven was nuts when he started showing people how to use dominant sevenths. They thought he couldn't hear anymore because he was going down.
Yeah. I'm sorry, could you get a little closer to that?
They were ahead of their time.
You say that, ahead of it, but I don't think you can be ahead of their time. I think the people were behind the time.
Yes.
Yeah. And that was you.
It's like the people catch up.
Yeah, they have to catch up.
There are actually certain critics who have still not caught up with Miles Davis.
Oh, I know. I know. Yeah. Well, because they're in a box. You have to be outside of a box in order to accept art. You can't come to something with preconceived ideas and notions and what you think this should be. This is the artist. That's why you come to see him. If you just want to see him recreate what's done on the record, then just stay home, listen to the records.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program, and our guest for this evening is Gary Bartz, saxophonist, alto soprano, educator, composer, producer, who will be celebrating 50 years of his Another Earth release at the Winter Jazz Festival on Thursday. You'll hear more about that during the On the Bandstand segment. What you're listening to right now is Love Always Rules from Dick Griffin and his release A Dream for Rasan and More. This was released on Ruby Records. Dick Griffin on trombone, Gary Bartz on alto sax, Stanley Cowell on piano, Cecil McBee on bass, and Billy Hart on drums. Before that, we heard a snippet from a Isle of Wight performance with Miles Davis. Call It Anything was what they were playing. This is from, actually, an Electric Miles DVD, 2004 Eagle Eye Media. Before that, we heard All Blues from Miles from India, 2008 Four Quarters Entertainment release, featuring Louis Banks on piano, Gary Bartz on alto saxophone, Ron Carter on bass, Ravi Chari on sitar, Jimmy Cobb on drums, Rudresh Mahathapa on alto sax, and Viku Vinyakram on gata. Before that, we heard Libra, a Gary Bartz composition from Max Roach. Members Don't Get Weary, 1968 Atlantic Records release. This is actually from a 2006 collectibles reissue. Max Roach on drums, Gary Bartz on alto sax, Charles Tolliver on trumpet, who will also be at the Another Earth celebration at Le Poisson Rouge on Thursday, Jimmy Merritt on electric bass, Stanley Cowell on piano. Before that, we heard What I Say from Miles Davis. This is a snippet, though, because that's a long selection, just so you can hear Gary Bartz during that time. This is from Live Evil, originally recorded in 1970 at the Cellar Door Columbia Records label. Miles Davis on trumpet, Gary Bartz soprano sax, John McLaughlin on guitar, Keith Jarrett on electric piano, Michael Henderson on bass, Jack DeJeanette on drums, Ayeto Moreira on percussion. Before that, we heard Red Cross from Tiny Grimes Quintet with Charlie Parker. This is from a compilation, The Complete Savoy and Dial Master Tapes. This was originally recorded in 1944 in WOR Studios. This is a 2002 Savoy Jazz Box set. Charlie Parker, alto saxophone, Clyde Hart, piano, Tiny Grimes, guitar, Jimmy Butts, bass, and Harold Doc West on drums. And of course, we opened our program with our theme from Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. Nina Simone, from the very best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972, on RCA BMG, originally recorded in 1967. This is a 1998 compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams, and more from Gary Bartz and Funkman Keen and me, Joyce Jones, right here on Sugar in My Bowl on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues. Visual artist as well, aren't you?
I paint a little.
Yeah. Have you ever exhibited? Or?
No.
Oh.
I've been asked, but I don't have enough things, I don't think, to do that.
I notice a lot of musicians. Actually, last month's guest was Dick Griffin.
Mm. Oh, I know Dick paints, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know his reason for doing it, because he was teaching at the time, and he had started, you know, he used to draw when he was younger or what have you. How did you wind up going in that direction?
really, it started because of I started meditating. And I don't really know how exactly I started, but I was drawing one day and I realized drawing is a form of meditation because you have to really focus on what it is you're drawing or painting. And so that was very helpful, and I began to really like doing that.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about being in the box, and Akeem, you apparently are a poet or rapper. It depends on who expresses who you are.
Musician.
Okay, okay. Now, being in a box of hip-hop, initially, you know, someone hears that you do what you do.
Yeah.
How do you get out of being placed into that box?
See, they put you in a box, like, they make it seem like it's all gangster, like everything's supposed to be gangster hip-hop, gangster rap and all that. But gangster is a different word for everything. Like, Oprah's a gangster in her way. Mm. Malcolm X was a gangster in his way.
Break it down.
Know
how?
What I mean?
How so?
Because, like, Malcolm fought for his people, and he got his people out of the mess they was in at that point. I mean, and that's a gangster to me in my eyes.
And Oprah?
Oprah, she, the same thing. She lifted the people up and fought for her thoughts. Mm-hmm. I mean, her dreams of evolving the people. Like, if you ain't making a difference, then what is you doing it for?
Mm.
I mean, you always got to make a difference. It's always your intentions on everything, I mean.
So how would you describe your music?
Describe it as good music.
Okay.
I mean, you know, really, you can't describe music.
Right.
It's impossible. That's why we don't need critics. And I always say the only people that need critics are people that don't listen, because they trust in somebody else to listen for them. Okay, I've listened to this, and I say this is good. You should listen. Yeah, come on. You can't listen to yourself, then you already got a problem. But
so tell me about your music, Kim. What is it that you express in your music that makes it different from what's around?
I let you know how it is, for real. How they got us tricked. I mean, how they trying to brainwash us and got us living for them. We ain't even living for us no more. Mm. We living for them. I mean, there's people out here with jobs, and they don't want to go to work every day. They're like, I don't want to go to work. So who are we living for?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm living for God.
Mm.
That's me. I mean, this ain't my music. This is God's music.
Uh-huh.
It is. That's right. It comes through us.
Right. So you want to give an example of what you do?
See, I sat at the table and ate the last supper with sire. Walked head high through the ferocious fury of fire. My land is nothing but snakes, fakes, creatures, and lies. But through ugly and nice, I reached for something higher.
That's good. That's real good.
You are.
Thank you.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for January 8th. This segment features aerial listings of Suge and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And tonight's guest is saxophonist Gary Bartz. You can see him recreate his classic Another Earth album at its 50th anniversary at Les Poissons Rouges on January 10th with fellow saxophonist Pharoah Sanders, who was also on the original recording. That event's part of the New York City Winter Jazz Fest, which runs through January 19th at various venues in and near Greenwich Village. We've got more festival details coming at the bottom of the segment, but before that, we have more listings for you this week. We start with drummer Andrew Surreal, who's at the Zurcher Gallery for a solo performance on January 9th. And this is actually a preview of this summer's Vision Festival presented by Arts for Art. Drummer Francisco Mora Catlett leads Afrohorn at Brooklyn Sisters Place on January 12th. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Session series continues with late Saturday night sets at Smoke on the 12th and the 19th. Drummer William Hooker is at the Bowery Poetry Club on the 13th with bassist William Parker. He'll also be at Shapeshifter Lab in Brooklyn on the 23rd. Bassist Ron Carter is at the Village Vanguard with Emmett Cohen's trio from the 15th through the 20th. Trumpeter Freddie Hendricks is at Zinc Bar on the 16th. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at Smalls on the 16th. Looking a little further ahead, tubist Joe Daly is at Terra Blues with Hazmat Modine on the 19th. finally, as we said earlier, the 2019 Winter Jazz Fest is underway, and it's running through the 12th at various venues in and around Greenwich Village, and the Marathon Nights of Music are on the 11th and 12th, and there are a couple individual events and talks on other nights. So to highlight a few specific events, John Medeski is at Brooklyn Steel on the 9th with Medeski, Martin, and Wood, and on the 10th, you have a choice. Michelle Ndege Ocello is at New Blue, and she's actually the artist-in-residence for this year, and Gary Bartz and Pharoah Sanders recreate the Another Earth album at Les Poissons Rouges. We've got the full schedule linked in our blog at blog.sugarinmybowl.org, and we urge you to check out our annual cheat sheet, which gives you in-depth guide to marathon nights, and make sure to stop by for coverage after it's all over. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the main website. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. If you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The support WBAI link on the Sugar in My Bowl website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off. With our new weekly schedule, we'll be back on air next Tuesday night at 10 p.m. and have updated event listings online. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it. I'm near you. You're
back to Gary. How did you hook up with Norman Connors and eventually Phyllis Hyman?
Well, I met Norman when I was working with Max Roach. I started working with Max and Abby in 1964. So somewhere in between those years, we were doing an engagement at a club in Philadelphia. I think it was the Aqua Lounge, or it could have been the Showboat. And they used to have a jam session on Saturdays. And Max would let musicians come in and play, and Norman came in and sat in on the drums. So that's the first time that I had met Norman. And so when he moved to New York, we kept in touch with each other and finally got the record deal and called me to do the record. And I met Phyllis on the record date.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that doing Betcha by Golly Wow?
Yeah.
That's you? All right, then.
Yeah, that was a very important record, I think,
yeah,
for a lot of people.
How did you experience Phyllis Hyman?
Oh, Phyllis was, I loved Phyllis so much. Really did. Mm-hmm. She was one of the great musicians of all time. She was just a natural. I mean, because I worked with her. I lived in California for about 5 years, from about 73, 74 to 79. And in 79, Phyllis was going out on tour, and she called me to go out on tour with her. We were opening for the OJs and the Spinners and Peabo Bryce and people like that. Mm-hmm. So they sublet me an apartment. I came to New York, and we rehearsed, and we went out on tour, and I started getting into so many things here in New York that I ended up moving back. You know, I ended up doing a play, and then the acting bug hit me.
What play? What play did you do?
It was called Bebop, the Hip Musical.
Huh.
It was off Broadway.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We
were going to Broadway because it was so much excitement about it. I mean, it was a beautiful thing, it really was. Diane McIntyre did the choreography and ended up doing a lot of the directing, too.
Mm. Who wrote the play?
It was really more of a review. We all wrote it. Ipatha Merkison, you know, from Law and Order, was in it.
Yes.
A lot of good people were in it. Tony Azito, who went on to win a Tony, and he's since passed away, but a lot of great people were in it.
I took you off your direction, though. You were actually talking about Phyllis Hyman.
Oh, yeah. So that's how I moved back to New York, working with Phyllis. But she was just a pure musician. She would never sing the song the same way. Now, singers sing the song the same way because they might get lost. Singers need the bass players to play tonics. Mm. They need everything to be just exactly the same so nothing throws them off.
Mm-hmm.
But real musicians, they just create, and so she'll hear somebody do something, and she'll sing something off of that, and I would hear her do that every night. I said, she sang Betcha by Golly Wow one night, greatest I've ever heard her sing it, and I heard her sing it many times,
mm-hmm.
but, I mean, this particular night, she, you know, because sometimes you reach,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, you know, but she would do this every night somewhere.
So you toured with her as well?
Oh, yeah.
Did you work with many singers?
Yeah, the first singer I worked with...
Well, it was Abby. Abby Lincoln.
No.
Oh.
First singer I worked with was Betty Carter.
Really?
Yeah. But she came to Baltimore to do a gig, and I was hired to be the horn player in the group. So that's the first time I worked with a singer. I mean, I had worked with local singers, you know, but really great musician singers was Betty and then Abby.
Well, tell me about that time with Betty Carter.
Oh, it was fun.
Because everybody's got a, you know, an experience.
Well, me and Betty were next-door neighbors. We lived right next door to each other in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
For about 3 or 4 years before I moved to California.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, we had a lot of fun.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
How was it working with her, though?
Oh, it was just a week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, but I learned stuff, you know. I love singers because that's what I do. Through my instrument, I sing. We sing. So I know when I first moved to New York, all of the horn players, musicians would say, you know, if I was playing a song, do you know the lyrics to that song? I never even thought that I needed to know the lyrics. Now I must know the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And a student of mine just told me, because I was telling him the same thing. I was telling him, I know you don't know the lyrics because I hear the way you're playing it, that you don't know the words. Got to learn the words. And he was saying, yeah, that's right. He said, I just heard a story about Ben Webster was in the studio recording a song, and in the middle of the song, he stopped the take because he forgot the lyrics.
Mm.
And he was playing the saxophone.
Right.
So that's how important that is.
Yeah.
So I've worked with many singers, Chaka Khan, people from, you know, but I love singers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Abby Lincoln as a singer, or as a musician.
Yeah, I'm telling you. Something magical just happened concerning Abby, because I wasn't able to go to her memorial, because I was in California with McCoy Tyner, and I was hoping, and I didn't ask anybody, I was just hoping someone would get me a program from the memorial. Now, I'll back up a little bit. One of my favorite songs of hers is called Throw It Away.
Mm-hmm.
And this song changed my life because I was on an airplane. I'm going to tell you this whole story. I was on an airplane going to Europe somewhere. And I got on the plane. I had my mini disc. I took all my stuff out before I sat down. I put my mini disc on my seat, put my luggage up above. When I came back, my mini disc was gone.
Oh, no.
And there was a guy that had come in that sat next to me. I knew he had it, you know, but I'm looking everywhere because I knew where I put it, but I'm looking everywhere. I look in the back of me because I had set things in the seat in back of me. People had come along. We were looking everywhere. I asked the stewardess to make an announcement, and she said, well, we better not do that because we don't want to alert, you know, for whatever reason. So I sat down, and I thought, I don't know whether I listened to it or just thought about the song Throw It Away, where she says, you cannot lose that which is yours.
You can never lose a thing if it belongs to you.
If it belongs to you.
Yeah.
So I rested in that. I leaned back, and I let that be my chair.
Yeah.
And I gave it up, and I started talking to the man, and we, you know, because I was, at first I was ready to throw him off the plane. You know.
Right.
But I thought of this song, and it calmed me down, and I said, yes, I think it's right. Because, and then I thought, I had lost, my horn was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
My Mark VI, that I, was my first horn that I bought,
mm-hmm.
was stolen out of the trunk of my car. It was missing for 2.5 years.
Wow.
I got it back.
Oh.
And that helped me, too, because I thought, well, you know, that was my horn. I was supposed to get it back. I still have it. You know, this was back in the 80s, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, when I had it, it was mine.
Right.
Now it's somebody else's, and I hope they get good. And I was cool.
Yeah.
And when we landed and we got off the plane, the gentleman next to me reached down under his seat and said, oh, is this what you were looking for?
Oh, my goodness.
So now that's the part of it. Now, this morning, so I had said I couldn't get to the memorial.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back, and no one had the program for me. It was at my friend's house. And I walked by, and there were two programs, because they had been there. And I asked, could I have one of these? They said, yes.
Mm.
She said, somebody just left it there.
Huh.
And I said, Abby made sure I got this program.
Wow.
And I almost cried.
Mm-hmm.
Really did. That's a powerful lady. That lady is a force, as Max.
Yeah. I thought of... when she transitioned, when Abby Lincoln transitioned, I thought of the Matrix. And I never really thought of Abby Lincoln as being the Oracle, but yeah, that's what I...
Oh, yeah.
That's what I thought.
That's right. I used to see her on the planes. She was writing lyrics then. She was always, back in the 60s, she was always writing. She hadn't really blossomed into the songwriter that she became then, but she was always working at it.
Yeah.
And that's what it takes, is that hard work and dedication, which people never see us do that, because they shouldn't. They should only see the result.
Do you think people are working like that these days?
Yeah, I think they will always.
Yeah.
Because it's not, the music just, you know, it chooses certain people.
Mm-hmm.
And if it, you know, sometimes they choose the right people. Sometimes it chooses the wrong. Sometimes people choose themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's one thing I tell students. You don't do this because it's cool or, you know, it's glamorous. You do it because you have to.
Mm.
So that's another thing.
Now, you've mentioned McCoy Tyner
several
times during the course of the conversation.
Mm.
How did you wind up working with him? Well, you're playing with him these days, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, we just got back from Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah. 3.5-week tour.
Wow.
It's alone. Like the old days. Yeah.
How did you wind up working with McCoy Tyner?
Well, I met McCoy when he was with the Jazz Tet. That's when I first met him. And of course, my love for John Coltrane, I was always around, so I knew him and would talk. And so when he left John, you know, he asked me to join the band, and we started recording, and we've been together ever since.
Yeah.
Off and on through the years.
How was it playing with him?
Oh, it was always a learning experience, mm-hmm. always.
What have you learned?
Oh, I mean, I can work on things that he understands. You know, when you play with musicians from your generation, where we all learn things together, then it, you know, he'll understand what I'm doing. Mm. Whereas if I play with younger musicians, sometimes they may or may not. You know, sometimes older musicians may or may not. So that's, you know, has nothing to do with young or old, but I just love playing with McCoy because he's so free and he can follow you. You know, his ears are so big, mm-hmm. he can follow you.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Thank you.
Do you play with younger people often?
Well, I teach at Oberlin Conservatory of Music. So.
Right. Do you have your own band?
Still? Oh, yeah. Okay. I've had my own band since the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, I have. Took my first band on the road in about late 50s. Mm-hmm. I would say about 59.
Wow. So when did you come up with Into Troop?
I was really reading a book about that. It was written by a German. I forget his name. But he was talking about Muntu, Kuntu, Kintu. He had studied the arts and the philosophies of Africa.
Mm.
And I was reading that book, and it intrigued me. And I like that my concept was trying to encompass all of the musics of and from Africa, mm-hmm. which is most of the musics around the world, mm-hmm. you know. So I was trying to incorporate all of them, which included Motown, you know, mm-hmm. and everything else, you know. And that came from my philosophy, the conversations with Max Roach, because he was saying, well, when you record songs by George Gershwin and Hoagie Carmichael, their family gets the royalties. Mm-hmm. But when you record songs by Duke Ellington and, you know, people like that, hopefully their families will get the royalties. So it's more nationalist mm-hmm. in concept, you know, at that time.
Right.
You know, we were in the 60s.
Right.
We were at war.
Right.
We really were. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean Vietnam.
Right. It was like stateside.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
So, we've always been at war, so that's, you know, we're still at war. So.
Every day.
Yeah. Our weapons are music.
Right.
Which are very powerful weapons. A note can break a glass or bring down the walls of Jericho.
Right.
So, music is very powerful.
And you worked with Andy Bay
mm-hmm.
around that time.
Yeah. Love Andy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the drinking song is probably my favorite song.
Oh.
Because it just spells it out. It just and
yeah.
I really enjoy that one.
Oh,
I can't get enough of that one.
The smoke, the game, until you free your mind.
abbreviated version.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Because crack wasn't around then.
Mm-hmm. Right. So speaking of Andy Bay,
mm-hmm.
how was that partnership? Because you did that for a while, and it wasn't just within two.
No, we worked in that together. I mean, we had worked before and after. I mean, he's one of my favorite musicians. Of all time.
Yeah.
Like Muhammad Ali.
Of all time.
Greatest.
Yes.
So it was good working with that. We were talking about working with vocalists. Right?
Yeah.
But Andy, he's taught me many things, too.
Mm-hmm.
Being that he's about 20 years older than me. I hope you hear that, Andy. No, we're around the same age.
Oh, okay. You're playing with younger people, and of course, yeah, you're an educator and you mm-hmm. teach students. But you also played with Roy Hargrove,
mm-hmm.
and you've recorded with him several mm-hmm. times.
Yeah.
How did he wind up asking for you?
Well, actually, when he was still in high school, the people that manage him now, and I think Walter Booker was working with the band, and they went down to Fort Worth, Dallas, the Caravan of Dreams. They wanted to record him at that point, and they called me to see if I would do the recording, and I said yes, which never happened at that time. He was still in high school, so, you know, eventually he graduated, went to Berkeley, and, you know, but we still kept in touch all of those years, so, you know, that's kind of how that happened.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So did you feel intimidated playing with a younger player?
Intimidated? You talking about them?
No, did
me?
You? Yeah.
Why would I feel intimidated?
I'm just asking.
Why would I feel intimidated?
Well, because they were probably more adventurous.
You think they would be?
I don't know. I'm wondering whether they could have been.
No, more than likely it would be the other way around.
Okay. Right.
I know when I was younger, I sure felt intimidated playing with older musicians.
Yeah.
Because they knew more.
Of course.
And there was no doubt that they knew more.
Right.
So why would, you know.
You never know. So well, I thought I could throw it out
me,
there anyway.
You know. No, no. I mean, music, first of all, it shouldn't even be about intimidation.
Right.
You know, because it's, you're all trying to do the same thing, mm-hmm. you know, if anything. It should be teamwork is
right.
what it is, which is why the greatest bands have always had a combination of young and old, mm-hmm. because you have the experience and you have the new, mm-hmm. and you can get some good music out of that and become a good band. But when it's all old or when it's all young, they don't have enough experience and they have no energy, or not as much energy, you know. With that young, you know, so mm-hmm. I think the greatest bands have to have a combination. But, no, there should be no intimidation anyway.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, when I joined Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, which was the band I joined after I left Max and the Happy, and I was fortunate enough to be in a band with Lee Morgan, who taught me so much.
Wow.
John Hicks. John actually helped get me in the band. And it was Victor Sprouls at the time. But we never rehearsed. We never had a rehearsal. Everything I learned in that band, I learned on stage.
Wow.
And so after that, nothing intimidated me. I knew I'd get on any stage with anybody and could hold my own, you know, at the age of 25. I knew that. So, no, I haven't been intimidated in years.
I could be wrong. But do you think that there are opportunities like Art Blakey's? Jazz Messengers? Okay.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
No, when I was younger, there were bands, and that's how you learn this music.
Mm-hmm.
You learn how to be a band leader. You learn how to call sets. You learn many things. You learn how to travel. You know, working with Art, I had never even spoken on a microphone before on the stage, and one night we finished the set, and he was trying to get off. He just handed me the mic and said, make the announcements. You mm-hmm. know, and I was terrified. That was intimidating.
Right.
Yeah, so there are no bands.
Right.
Because, and I think it has to do business-wise, bands, you can't control a band, like Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. You can't tell Art Blakey who to have in your band, like record labels try to do nowadays. When Art Blakey goes in to do a record date, they're going to ask him, okay, so who are you going to use on this date? He says, my band.
Mm-hmm.
Who you think I'm going to use? Nowadays, you go in, they want to tell you who to use.
Mm-hmm.
That's your band. You're creating the music. But the thing is, you don't have to do it. I've never done that.
Mm-hmm.
I've done over 40 records. No one has ever told me who to put. They've made suggestions, and I might like the suggestion.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't tell me who to put on my record date.
Right.
You can't do that. But, you know, a lot of people want to record so bad that they will believe the record label, you know, here, put these, and then you put these people on there even though you don't agree with it, and then they don't promote the record. So that means you've been tricked.
Right.
You know, so anyway. No, they're not the opportunities that they once were, but there are other kind of opportunities, like the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, everybody's a star. You know, people you never heard of. You see this big website. So, oh, my Lord, this guy must be really great. And then you listen to him and you say, what? Man, but they're still in elementary school playing a rented horn. You know,
yeah.
You know, I had a discussion with a pianist one time, and I said, he was asking me something similar to that, and I said, music will find a way. Art will find a way. So, okay, we don't have that. There'll be other things. Nowadays, it's the schools. Even though I find the students coming in are nowhere nearly prepared as they should be, but, you know, that's why they come to schools. So.
Do you see musicians sort of coming into community? Because I was talking to Randy Weston about this. He was talking about how the musicians should find time to come out of the school and into the communities.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, at Oberlin, the community is welcome to come on campus and listen to the students when they do that. They do forums every week, two and three, probably five or six bands. The students will get together and form groups within. And so, you know, the public is welcome.
Right. So they're welcome to listen. It's not as though, you know, some teenager down the street could come with his instrument and join a workshop.
Yeah, but they can come and talk and listen at the forums. But the forums usually have critiques after they play songs. And sometimes maybe some of the outside public does come. And there is a program for the elementary schools around the area.
Okay.
So, no, they're very instrumental. My school is.
Oh, okay.
We're trying to get Brother Youssef out to the school. I'm trying to. I
think
it's
going to
happen. But I said, oh, my. Brother Youssef, man.
Yeah, he's an incredible instructor.
Giant.
Yes.
He's a giant, yeah.
The Brooklyn jazz scene. Excuse me. I just walked right into that.
Scene.
Oh, my God, the Brooklyn music scene.
You know what I tell you? And I've been insulting people. Uh-huh. But, you know, because I get insulted when they say that to me because they figure I'm playing a style of music. They don't assume.
Right.
You know, so nowadays they'll say, what do you call your music? I say, it's called music, stupid.
I've just been so indoctrinated with that word being thrown at me.
I know we all have, yeah. But so have we with the N-word.
That's true.
And yeah, some words, you just got to, you don't use them.
Well, that one I don't use. No. I don't use the N-word.
Ever?
I don't. I wasn't.
Not even when somebody makes you mad?
Never. Ever. It's not even part of.
Oh, you.
Freaker.
Oh, that's intimidating.
Yeah.
But see, words, really nothing has a name.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is whatever it is.
Right. So the Brooklyn music scene.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about it.
Well, when I first moved to New York, like I say, in 58, I was going to Juilliard. I rented a room right off of Broadway on 151st. And I met Gracian Moniker. I met Andrew Cyril. And we became really good friends. We were like the Three Musketeers. Mm-hmm. Gracian lived in Newark. Andrew lived in Brooklyn. He came from the Marcy Avenue Projects where Jay-Z came from, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we used
near
to,
my
he was on the Nostrand Avenue side.
Oh, okay.
Andrew was.
As opposed to the Marcy Avenue side.
So I used to go over to Brooklyn. At that time, there was a thriving scene. There was the Baby Grand in Brooklyn. There was the Turbo Village. There was the Blue Clarinet. There was the Club Continental. There were just many clubs. So I used to hang over there, even though I lived in Harlem. So most of my friends ended up being in Brooklyn. Sonny Rollins was living there then. Actually, I lived right across the street. I lived on the St. James Place, which is where Biggie came from. He lived on the St. James. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You do keep up.
Yes, I do.
You're not stuck in the past.
Definitely
right?
Not. Right?
Or a box.
No.
Because that's a great poet there.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we used to go to all the jam sessions and hang out in Brooklyn, and it was just a thriving music scene, and, you know, as Harlem was, too. But all my friends were from Brooklyn, and I ended up eventually moving to Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
So good learning time. Actually, one of my first, I was just telling Akeem, one of my first big, I call it big engagements in New York, was at the Turbo Village. I used to see KD there, Kenny Dorham.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
What made it big, the engagement?
Well, because it was they were hiring top name groups, and so we were really not, we had no names. Gracian, it was a group with Gracian, Andrew Cyril, and I, you know, had formed, and we got this gig. I actually got fired on the second week, which was good for me because it made me go back to Baltimore that summer and work like the devil. I said, I'm never going to get fired for my playing. But the club owner felt I didn't have a name, and he thought my sound was weak. So I went home and got that together.
Now, Gretchen McClure, his name has come up a lot when I've talked to people. What is it that a lot of people need to know about him that you think we might not know?
I mean, he's a great musician, for one thing. He was, he actually taught me harmony.
He was a trombonist.
Yeah. He taught me the concepts of a harmony, theory and harmony. He was the one that really got me started with that, so that I understood. Because when I moved to New York, I was totally here, as all musicians should be. And every great musician has a great ear. The ear's wide open. You have to have your ears wide open. And that's one thing I notice with a lot of younger musicians. Their ears are locked because they start out on the printed page. And the printed page came second. You have to hear it before anybody can write it.
Right.
Somebody has to hear it. So he wrote some beautiful songs, and he's just a good person. He's my oldest son's godfather.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, your music has been sampled.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
I love it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are things handled properly? Are you...
Sometimes.
Okay.
Sometimes I get paid, sometimes I don't.
Okay.
But that works all over the whole thing. Some students were asking me the other day, we've got this show coming up. You think we should sign a contract? I said, yes. You know, because I was telling them about the times I've been stranded. I've gone out on the road to do certain gigs. We didn't get paid. Now we don't have enough money to get home, you know. So all kinds of things. But that's because we didn't have contracts, you know.
So have you heard what's been done with your work?
A lot of it,
okay. You're good with it?
Yes.
Okay.
Why wouldn't I be? Yeah. Why would I? I mean, well, I appreciate that they're even, that they understand the music and that they're listening. But what it shows is that there's no difference. See, we try to break it up in, okay, this is hip-hop now. Oh, he sampled from this. It's all the same.
Yeah.
We're influenced by them. You know what I mean? We get our influence from them. Without them, we wouldn't be here.
Right.
That's right.
Like Q-Tip, he sampled my dad on that Butter track.
Oh, yeah. And Tribe Called Quest.
They dang on that track.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been sampled a lot.
So do you sample your father's work?
I'm working on it, but I need some mechanics. I need some people behind the beats.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But we got a lot of things we're working on.
Yeah,
I'm working on with him for real.
Studio at home. Yeah. That's where he did this.
And my other one, this
mixtape is called "How to Spit Crack for Dummies." I'm saying, if you know, some people they hear a curse word, you know,
they get stuck on that one curse word.
No? Yeah. Rather than listen to the whole content of the word. Because, see, we can get away with it because we play instruments. We curse all the time.
Right. You just can't tell.
You just can't tell.
Right.
Unless it's Eric Dolphy, then Mingus, you can tell.
Well, Mingus, you can certainly tell.
Yes, you can.
Pharrell Sanders, when he was in Brooklyn this year for...
the Brooklyn Consortium?
Yes, Brooklyn Consortium. And you came by.
Yeah, you invited.
I extended his invitation.
His invitation.
Yes.
Through you. Yeah.
Right. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I wouldn't miss the opportunity to play with my friend.
So were you and Pharrell together in the Brooklyn music scene?
Well, the New York music scene.
Okay.
Yeah. I met Pharrell in the early 60s.
Okay.
And he's a Libra. I'm actually about a week older than him.
Okay.
I see he's a little kind of,
uh-huh.
How you doing, young man? Yeah, so we're both Libras and everything, and we both love John Coltrane. And we met at a jam sessions, and we started practicing together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And he taught me many things.
Yeah.
We used to go out to Riverside Park and play in the park. Yeah. Try to open our sounds, get our sounds together. But, we spent a lot of time together.
Yeah, we actually had him as a guest earlier this year
when
he was in town. Yeah. So that was actually during the time of the consortium. So that was really fun.
He's really a good friend.
Yeah.
You can meet a class. I feel like I'm in school.
Oh, we've got an educator in our midst.
Oh, well.
What are you up to? You came back from Europe. What do you have next?
Well, I have to do my school commitments, you know, because they're gracious enough to allow me to arrange my schedule around my touring schedule. I've been there 9 years, and it's working out good.
Excellent.
Yeah, it's a heck of a school, I tell you.
Yeah.
And the department... We have a new $10-15 million state-of-the-art building dedicated to this music.
Excellent.
So I'm doing that and still touring with McCoy and my band occasionally. We're getting ready to release an album.
When is the official release?
Not sure. It depends on what we do label-wise. I have my own label, and I refuse to ever give up another master. Won't do that ever again. Unless they make me an offer I can't refuse. I mean, I believe in what Chuck D from Public Enemy says. If you don't own the master owns you.
Yes.
And I will not, you know, we've been through slavery twice, at least. Yeah, may still be in it, but, you know, we're so brainwashed, sometimes we can't see it.
Who's playing with you?
On that album, my regular group is Greg Bandy on drums, Barney McCall on keyboards, piano and keyboards, James King on bass. We also have guests, Andy Bay.
Hey.
Yeah. Andy Bay sings Dear Lord and Bring Tears to Your
Eyes.
It's a Coltrane. It's called Coltrane Rules.
Oh.
Tale, T-A-O, of a Music Warrior. And it's a double CD set.
Wow.
And Renee McLean is on some of it.
Excellent.
He
just joined my Facebook list.
Good. Yeah.
Are you coming to Facebook?
Yeah, eventually.
Okay.
You know, I've got so much on my plate right now. That's just wait for him to set me up. He's waiting for me to get set up.
I'm on there. I'm Funkman Keem. K-E-E-M.
Okay. Yeah. Funkman Keem.
Yeah, he's got videos on there all the time.
Okay.
I mean, stuff all over.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Gary Bartz, Funkman Keem, for visiting Sugar in My Bowl.
Thank you for having us.
Dear Lord, my heavenly Father, your compassion and mercy.
You're listening to the closing moments of Sugar My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones, and we begin our airing on WBAI on Tuesday evenings from 10 to midnight. What you're listening to in the background is Dear Lord from Gary Bartz. As a matter of fact, when I got this recording, you just gave it to me on some CD. It wasn't an actual CD for purchase yet, so many thanks to Gary Bartz for doing that. Coltrane Rules, Tao of a Music Warrior. That's what the release eventually became, released in 2012 on Oyo Records. Personnel includes Andy Bay on lead vocals and Renee McLean on flute. Before that, we heard a snippet from Celestial Blues from Gary Bartz into Troop Harlem Bush Music Uhuru. This is originally recorded in 1972 on Atlantic Records. This is a collectibles reissue. Before that, we heard My Shining Hour from Roy Hargrove of Kindred Souls. And before that, we heard Drinking Song from Gary Bartz into Troop with Andy Bay on lead vocals. And before that, we heard Solstice. This is a Gary Bartz composition from McCoy Tyner's Illumination release, 2004, Telok Records. McCoy Tyner on piano, Gary Bartz on saxophones, Terrence Blanchard on trumpet, Christian McBride on bass, and Louis Nash on drums. Before that, we heard Saman Bukman Umyan. You always have a problem with that title. We heard the title selection from the 1970 Impulse Records release from Pharoah Sanders. Pharoah Sanders is on soprano sax and various percussion, including cowbell. He's also playing thumb piano and wood flute. Gary Bartz is on alto saxophone, bells, shakers, other percussion. Woody Shaw is on trumpet. He's yodeling on other selections and on percussion. Lonnie Liston-Smith is on piano, cowbell, other percussion. Cecil McBee is the bassist. Clifford Jarvis on drums. Nathaniel Bettis on xylophone, yodeling, African percussion. And Anthony Wiles on conga and African percussion. Before that, we heard a bit from Gentle Smiles. That's from Gary Bartz's 1975 Prestige Records release, The Shadow Do. Gary Bartz on alto, soprano, saxophone, synthesizer, lead, background vocals, composer, co-producer. Michael Henderson on bass, M2Me, James M2Me on congas and percussion. Howard King on drums, synthesizer, Reggie Lucas on guitar, Hubert Eves on piano, clavinet, synthesizer. Larry and Fonce Mizell were the producers. They also provided background vocals, and Larry Mizell also played synthesizer. And before that, we heard Phyllis Hyman, Bet You By Golly Wow. This is from a compilation, One on One, on Hippo Records. Norman Connors featuring Phyllis Hyman. This is arranged by our former Sugar guest, Onaji Allen Gums, and he's also on piano on this selection. Norman Connors on drums, Neil, Chief Baba Neil Clark on percussion, and Gary Bartz on alto saxophone. And before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Stay tuned for more on WBAI, and Sugar in My Bowl will be back next week, January 15th. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.